Author of the Week, featuring another great creator of narratives for the human race on Southside Broadcasting and Siren Radio.
Dystopias and utopias, they are the stuff of so much science fiction, speculative fiction, and otherwise. But there's a recent text which I have to say I'm particularly fascinated by because it probably alludes to the dreams of Elon Musk, multi-billionaires, even Jeff Bezos and so on, and whether they'd actually leave the planet Earth and leave it for half a millennia and then maybe come back when they actually feel it's best and livable once again. Of course, we have to deal with those who are left behind. The novel is called Indigent Earth, and we're delighted to actually welcome the author of the aforementioned Indigent Earth to the program today, the awesomely talented Scott Overton. How are you, Scott?
I'm very well, Alex. Thank you for having me. It's a delight to be here.
Well, it's great to connect with your good self. And I have to say, haven't quite finished the text as yet, but a gripping start, which, of course, starts off with the lead soul, one of your main characters that's actually based within that, Killian Morningcloud, who gets back to his home base only to find that actually the colonists are coming back after 500 years. And let's go and find them.
That's right. I suppose we should set it up. I mean, the story begins as the wealthiest of the world, the rich one percenters or whatever we want to call them, abandoned the Earth 500 years earlier because of the damage, climate change, you name it, pollution, everything else. So they go to live in space colonies. And as the story begins, they have promised and now are going to come back to Earth. So Killian's an Earthman who's looking forward to this. He's living in a stagnant community known as an allocation, which is like a reserve, if you think of it in terms of indigenous people. And he thinks that the return of the colonists is going to lift him out of this dead-end life, and it's going to be a golden age and wonderful. And so he's looking forward to it. It doesn't turn out that way.
Very much so. I mean, the interesting thing, of course, is, I mean, I mentioned in the introduction, the likes of Elon Musk, the likes of Jeff Bezos, obviously other multi-billionaires are available. But clearly, both Bezos and Musk have made a great play of the fact that certainly Mars is where they'd like to be headed. And I think it's interesting that you do talk about, in a sense, going off-world, but not off-solar system. This is something which is, in a sense, not quite doable in the foreseeable future, but in the, you know, shall we say, the next few decades, conceivably this could well be an opportunity if, of course, you've got the money.
That's right. And I mean, in my scenario, at the time that they left Earth, they kind of led everybody to believe they were creating these interstellar spaceships, but then used them as colonies. And that, you know, this the structure can be very, very similar. And if you think about it, the billionaires, you mentioned Musk and Bezos, of course, they're big in the space industry right now with SpaceX and Blue Horizon. And, you know, it's just, could it happen? I think it could. I don't know if it will. I don't know if they'd want to do that. But I don't think it's unrealistic to expect that 100 years from now, that may indeed happen. Mm.
The major drivers, of course, for the first space race were military. The shock that Sputnik actually caused the United States to actually feel very much led to the space race, very much led to, some might say, yes, non-stick frying pans and Teflon. So there's a couple of things that came out of the space race. But there is, of course, this line that actually there was a drive to get private entrepreneurial interests involved with the whole thing. The analogy was drawn very much with Magellan, with Marco Polo, with the explorers of the 14th, 15th, 16th centuries and so on. Do you think that that's still a valid comparison? Or do you feel as though actually, as with all sorts of things, history might not necessarily repeat itself, but it may be using the same rhythm?
Well, I'm not sure that it's going to end up being like that. I don't think it's a valid comparison because I would hope that we're not going to be colonists to some new worlds that we may discover. First off, it's going to be very difficult to go beyond the solar system. I don't think that'll take, something real very, very soon. But going out into space, the private companies, don't get me wrong, I don't have anything wrong with private industry being in the space business because they are doing it much more efficiently in many cases. And SpaceX in particular, with their reusable rocket boosters and things like that, that is a great step forward. And the more you can reduce the cost of getting things from the Earth into space, the better it will be to be able to use it for whatever, you know, exploit space in whatever way you think of, good or bad, I suppose. So I don't object to that. I just think that it is a possibility that they would have the means, not only the money, but also the infrastructure with their own companies to be able to do that kind of thing. Now, as far as, you know, the story, Indigent Earth has a very strong colonialism theme, but it isn't about going out into space, discovering a new race or a new species on an extra terrestrial planet and colonial, you know, being a colonist there, colonizing the planet. It is about the inequality of these wealthy people that go out to space colonies and then come back to those of us left behind on the Earth. So it's very much about economic inequality. It's very much about privilege. And I think that in the future, any of us could end up on the wrong side of the privilege divide. I think that colonialism of the future could be the wealthy, the uber wealthy, and the rest of us, you know?
And allowing for that line, of course, that brings us around to a lot of debates that have been taking place, certainly in Britain over the last few years, about the digital divide. The fact that the very conversation that we're having now via Zoom, there is a significant proportion of the people of our people, maybe a quarter, 20%, 25%, possibly maybe a little bit lower, who actually do not have access to that. They literally cannot afford to have the broadband facilities because of a cost of living crisis, because of other areas that are actually involved with the whole thing, possibly educational aspects as well. Do you feel as though that disconnect is still as large as ever? Is that something which you're attempting to echo in terms of what you've written about in this particular novel?
Well, there will always probably be underprivileged if we cannot solve those issues of incoming inequality, of course. As far as connectedness goes, I mean, every government in at least, you know, very well-developed countries is probably saying, we're working really hard to make sure everyone has access to all this wonderful technology and digital technology and connectedness. And are they doing a good job or not? It's hard to say. I mean, I'm from Canada. I live in Northern Ontario, Canada. It's a very, very large country. And so to try to get infrastructure for internet is very difficult to everyone in rural areas and certainly underprivileged, underdeveloped communities, particularly indigenous communities and things like that. It's difficult to do that. In the UK, I'm not sure whether you have those same challenges, but of course, there will always be economic challenges as far as affordability. My geographic location, I was using cellular phone for my internet for a number of years. I just recently got Starlink, you know, speaking of Elon Musk, and it is very valuable to people in distant rural locations. Of course, it's not cheap, but it does do the job. So those kinds of things, it's kind of like the way cell phones proliferated around what we would call the underdeveloped, less developed world, because the infrastructure of landlines was very, very expensive, very difficult because of terrain or whatever. And it was easier to actually do mobile networks. Well, something similar to Starlink, and I believe Jeff Bezos is planning to do something similar. There are some other ventures that are going to be quite similar to Starlink, multiple satellites passing overhead and passing your signal on to them, the next one, much like cell towers. That will possibly be the answer to what you're talking about, the difficulty of that 20% or so having the connections that everybody else is taking for granted.
There is, of course, the inbuilt presumption that everybody wants to be connected, because one of the fascinating aspects that I think he managed to draw neatly on in Indigent Earth is that Killian Morningcloud's family, some of his more experienced forebears, are probably much more in tune with nature, much more focused on that. There is a line that actually in many ways the hyper sanitized, technologically based, technologically determinist world in which a majority of people tend to exist is actually complete anathema to the human spirit, and that actually we should be actually embracing a much more simplistic, more rural based lifestyle.
Well, it certainly comes more naturally to me. I do live, well out about an hour from the nearest city, and in the kind of it's not wilderness, but it's out in the forest, in the boreal forest, and I do enjoy that very much. But at the same time, I'm not a technophobe. I'm online a lot of the time. I have to do my authorial work online and in interviews like this. So, there's the good and the bad. In Indigent Earth, Killian lives in, as I mentioned, a very small community called an allocation, but it's an enforced sort of community. They were pushed to live there and supported and encouraged to stay there because there is what they call depots. They're factories for food and clothing and everything else that supply the needs of the community. But there's the good and the bad. It means it kind of takes away any kind of entrepreneurial element to it, or very much of that. So everybody is living in these communities because they can get food, they can get clothing, and it's all supplied for them. Was that something generous, an act of generosity when all the wealthy people left and created these allocations and created these depots? That's another question. That's another big question in the novel. And Killian's family, in particular, his aunt and uncle that he spent some time with, don't want to live that way. They want to live out on their own, but there are challenges to that too.
Science fiction is inevitably going to reflect the period that it emerges from. This has been true of Mary Shelley, H.G. Wells, Isaac Asimov, Robert Heinlein, Ursula K. Le Guin, Octavia Butler, and presumably even Scott Overton as well from that
A
perspective.
hundred percent, 100%. That's what science fiction is.
Following on from that, then, Scott, do you see SF as being more of an allegory or more of a metaphor? Or more of a future predictor in terms of, or a combination of all three.
Well, it can be a combination of all three, but it definitely is, metaphorical and allegorical. I don't know how much we can actually predict things. Science fiction has predicted a lot of future technology and things like that. I won't take that away from it, but I don't personally try to do that very much. I think of how much technology has changed and how much it has changed our society just since the iPhone came out, for instance. And how could we have predicted how the personal computer and iPhones, smartphones would have changed our society? Maybe a few people did, but I'm not one of them. And so to try to predict technology 100, 200, 300 years out, I just don't even feel I can do that. In the case of Indigent Earth, of course, there was a sort of reset where, a lot of the scientists left with the wealthy people and went to live in colonies in space. Whether they were that interested in progressing technology at that point or not is, I've kind of said not. And on Earth, definitely not technological progress. It was just a matter of survival at that point. So it is about colonialism and the economic inequality of our times. I mean, Oxfam does regular reports, other organizations do regular reports on the distribution of wealth around the world and say that, the billionaires of the world, among the 2 or 3,000 billionaires there are, own about half of the wealth of the world, compared to the poorer half. And about 60% of the new wealth created in just the last few years. The pandemic of COVID-19 only made things more so that way. And there's just this huge divide of wealth that doesn't make sense. And it lately is getting worse. Things were better when the rich were taxed more about 50, 60 years ago in our countries. And now, I mean, you still have a pretty high tax rate for the wealthy in the UK compared to some places. But nonetheless, there needs to be more equality when it comes to the distribution of wealth. So that is allegorical.
500 years to some may seem like a drop in the cosmic ocean, given that we are the stuff that hydrogen atoms can emerge into, given several billion years of cosmic evolution, thanks to Carl Sagan at least. if we go back 500 years, we're in the 1600s. We are pretty much looking at the 17th century and so on. That is pretty much, although it's recorded history, yes, it's something where, you know, it's almost ancient history. In many ways, you could arguably say that even the early 20th century, the early to mid 20th century is almost in the line of almost oral history and recorded history. Now, was there a reason for setting 500 years as opposed to 150 years, a smaller span of time, or indeed a greater one?
Well, of course, the exodus, as they call it, doesn't happen for 100 years from now when the technology makes it more feasible and climate change damage and other damage makes it more necessary. But the ostensible reason for that happening is to let the Earth heal. And so 500 years is kind of the time that is picked to let the Earth heal somewhat. Would it heal everything? Probably not. But it would make a difference. We've seen what can happen even with places like Chernobyl after they are left and nature begins to get another toehold back in. So it's a reasonable time. I thought it was a reasonable amount of time, but that is the reason. They say that they're going to let the Earth heal and then they'll come back. What they're going to do when they come back is another issue.
And it's a different area, but I think the Hiroshima and Nagasaki bombs, the fact that nature returned very rapidly after what was deemed to be an extraordinary, devastating incident or in series of incidents, probably argues that, yes, at the end of the day, it's not so much the planet Earth that's necessarily in trouble, it's the human race that might be creating trouble for itself.
Very much so, yes. Now, climate change is another one where, it, you know, 500 years, if we go beyond certain tipping points, it may not be able to reverse itself in 500 years. It might not make that much difference. In Indigent Earth, I've kind of said, yeah, it's made a difference. Things are livable, but for the people that survived, the population was drastically, drastically reduced. And, you know, it's, as I explained with Killian, his life is a dead end with no prospects, no bright future in this community that's just not got any ambition or progress.
There is that dream, and say in that opening chapter where he's actually making his way through the blizzards, through the snowstorm, through all manner of areas. And there was an interesting point, I thought, in particular, where you have him decide making that decision. Should he actually take all his clothes or should he leave his laundry on the lines that might demonstrate that he is actually coming back?
To his family, indeed. Well, he hopes that they will, that the colonists will come back and they'll take him away into space with them. How likely that is, not very. And then, of course, the other side of the coin is the other main protagonist of the story, whose name is Natira Celestia. She is part of the aristocracy of the colonies, who have turned into that kind of a society, and a video celebrity as well. So she's almost like a princess. She has studied Earth. She was genetically enhanced at birth or after birth, before birth, to be able to come back to Earth. The whole return to Earth was planned. So a generation of selected embryos were enhanced to be able to withstand or at least readapt to the gravity of Earth again. And she is one of that cohort. And she is looking forward to Earth. She studied it and readied herself for this, thinking it's a world of noble savages, wise people who live in the woods and have, you know, gotten in tap with what life is really about. So she's looking forward to that. Of course, both her idea and Killian's idea are totally wrong. And then they come together in a clash of total opposites that will bring about a whole long plot of survival, dark secrets unveiled, a whole lot more. It is an adventure story. It's not a diatribe against, you know, colonialism or inequality. That's just a strong theme of it.
And of course, the other line that comes across there is the views and the perspectives that people do have. We often have the notion of cultural relativism, the fact that people do have the notions, as you alluded to there, of the noble savage, and suddenly going native can carry its own connotations and challenges as well. We've spoken about ideologies indirectly, Scott, or certainly with respect to the notion of technocrats and a new ruling class of technocrats, etc. Let's talk politicians, because again, H.G. Wells obviously famously wished to have a race of philosopher leaders, Platonic scientist leaders, until, as I think was pointed out on a number of occasions in his latter years, that ultimately would lead to fascism or indeed communism in terms of the ideological solution. Do you think we're anywhere close to getting a kind of solution? When we look at the planet today, in addition to climate change, in addition to, some might say, climate change hypocrisy with certain instances, you've also, of course, got the outbreak of wars. You have the situation in the Middle East. You have the Ukraine. You have other challenges. Is there a solution? I mean, is world government something which is a distant dream, or is it a nightmare, or should we just basically all look to go to heck in our own handbaskets?
Well, you know, I grew up with science fiction as a real love of mine, and there are a lot of utopian kind of pictures, not least of which is Star Trek. And when I first watched the Star Trek in its original run, and very often since, it is a sort of utopian society that they've developed there, where money is not the main driver.
Unless you're Ferengi, of course.
Well, exactly. You know, and so it is more of a virtue-based society rather than a money-based society. Hard to explain, and we don't have to get into it, but there is just a, you know, hopefulness for that kind of peaceful society where people get by on their merits, where there is equality, and or pretty darn close to it. So I'd like to believe, I have that hope for the possibility of the human race. Of course, there has been no indication that we could do that over all of recorded history. It's just not turned out that way. And when I have a case of all the wealthy people and the scientists that they can lure to go along with them going out into space, into these space colonies, and for 500 years, they don't make substantial progress as far as, you know, going into extrasolar travel, interstellar travel, or anything like that. I think that that is based on the view that I see of them and the way they behave now. There are a few who have these dreams that they are pursuing. And how many of those are there as far as space or progress or anything of that? Handfuls of the 2,000 plus billionaires that are out there? I think most of them are just going to be self-indulgent, to be honest. And as far as government goes, is there a world government around the corner? Well, the way we're going is mega corporations and global mega corporations and more of that kind of thing. Capitalism, as opposed to a world government in the way of democracy around the world. You know, there is a democracy spreading individual countries. That's great. But as far as a consolidated world government, there isn't a lot of movement since the United Nations was formed, you know, and the various different elements of it, the different agencies involved with the UN. Could they be consolidated? There is a possibility. Will it happen? That's another question. I don't think a natural things thing for humans, and the more equality or inequality there is in wealth, I think the less likely something like that is going to happen.
Interesting that the television series Continuum a few years ago, which set itself up in 2070, although obviously had time travel going back to 2012 and so on, was arguing that the biggest fear we had was more, as you said, of corporations and conglomerates rather than elected leaders, which again is an interesting line. As someone who was very fortunate enough back in the 1980s to actually meet Gene Roddenberry, the great brother of the galaxy, I, like yourself, have been heavily influenced by his legacy, by Star Trek in its original incarnation, and frequently turn around to when people start saying about how novel the sense of diversity and inclusivity is. Of course, this was at the core of the whole IDIC, infinite diversity in infinite combinations, long before it became a politically fashionable football to be kicked around, as it would seem today.
I know. I can't believe it when people will talk about the recent Star Trek incarnations being woke, and they say it as a bad word. And I think, have you watched the show? Did you watch the first? It was the most diverse and egalitarian show you could imagine at the time. And it has stayed true to that for the most part since. Yeah. So I don't know where that's coming from. It just kind of blows my mind.
Again, it's interesting because, of course, in some senses, possibly some might say, and this is an interesting debate, beginning with the Wrath of Khan movie, becoming a darker environment. I mean, I think one of the things we actually had, even up to and including Star Trek the Motion Picture, was a world in which we quite happily want to exist in. We quite happily had a meritocracy, a world where we didn't have to worry about gathering the next shekel or pound or whatever dollar currency you happen to be working in. And yet we did seem to actually move from them to a more of a militaristic approach, which even with Next Generation, post-Borg War, Deep Space Nine, post-Dominion War, and of course the range of corruption that we saw evident in Star Trek Discovery, and indeed in Strange New Worlds at times, seems to still be sort of biting on there. Is there something in the human spirit that actually likes to embrace the dark side, do you feel? I mean, it's a bit like we have our own collective enemy within that we have to constantly battle against, but we need both in order to function.
I would say yes, but it's also a necessity of drama. If you want to have drama, you have to have conflict. And the more, you know, you take away conflict in a society, the harder it is to create drama. If you think about the original Star Trek series, they went all over the place and encountered all these different societies on different worlds. And those worlds had conflict. Those worlds had dramatic settings that the crew would, you know, be involved with. But it wasn't the Federation. It wasn't Starfleet that had those conflicts. Well, they've just kind of taken it in the direction where, you know, there's more conflict within the organization itself and within the planetary and Federation system. But I think it's about the drama. And yet, I think that we do, of course, embrace the dark in many ways. I love disaster movies. I love disaster stories and have written some, because they are also, they're scary, but they also bring out, I think, some of the best in people, at least in fiction. But we've also seen that, you know, think about the beginning of COVID, when people really, you know, it brought out the best in people in many, many cases. As it wore on, not so much. Mm-hmm. But we do embrace disasters. We love horror stories and scary stories and things like that. So there is a darkness. And I think society, there's an ebb and flow of positivity and negativity, depending on what's happening with our economies and the world situations politically and everything else, where sometimes darker things just prevail. And maybe we'll come out of that into a time when we've got a lot more lighter entertainment. Certainly with COVID, people wanted lighter entertainment. I did. And it just, I think there's a bit of both. It's partly the drama that we need for theatrical productions, books, art needs some conflict and drama. And partly that occasionally we do embrace that dark part because it's scary. Sometimes scary is fun.
Well, certainly the whole notion of stagnant societies, as in the Archons, and Return of the Archons, as in the Apple, with, of course, the casting out of paradise, as in A Taste of Armageddon, and many other Kirk versus the computer scenarios. I think we all see an interesting sort of perception in terms of how that's being viewed and so on. Even, of course, with the ultimate computer being what happens when your job is being replaced by a computer. But that's, again, for any aficionados to actually dig deep into the original series mythology and find out some of those gems.
But they explained, they explored some great, great themes. There's one of the things that I have against some of the later iterations of the show is that they've followed these long story arcs that don't explore all these great themes that the original series did. And that is what science fiction did and does when it's at its best. It explores these themes, as you said earlier in our chat, about our current society, about the world that we live in. It reflects that to us in ways that use imagination, that use metaphor and allegory, but they are a reflection of the concerns that we have in our own society, of whatever it might be, extrapolating problems. The book that I brought out before Indigent Earth is called Augment Nation, And it's about brain augments. It's about the technology of having a computer brain interface, brain computer interface hooked up so that you can think your way to the internet and many, many other things that you would use. It's like talking about our smartphones now and the risks inherent and the dangers inherent, the privacy issues and much, much more, and extrapolating from that. So that, I think, is what science fiction does at its best. And it's wonderful literature for that.
And indeed, William Gibson also arguably led the way into the field of cyberpunk, building on the work of Philip K. Dick back in the 1960s, although Dick didn't refer to what he was doing as cyberpunk as such. I think it certainly has a precursor, certainly in the Ridley Scott incarnations.
And talk about dark. I mean, you know, Neuromancer and so many works that have been influenced by that are pretty dark vision of the future, thanks to technology.
Let's talk about technology, multi-platform approaches and so on and so forth. Clearly, I have my e-copy of Indigent Earth to hand on my tablet. I may well actually go for a hard copy as well. Just out of interest, this is a little fun question in many ways, Scott. Do you prefer your readers to actually read your books physically as hard copies or on a screen or listen to them via audiobooks, or is it as long as they're consuming them? I'm quite happy.
Well, I don't have a preference as far as how they read them. They can read them or enjoy them in whatever form they want. But I do sell them in person at various places like craft shows and markets sometimes, just because I really want to get that print copy, physical copy in the hands of readers who love that kind of thing. And I can autograph it and personalize it and that sort of thing. So I get a great pleasure out of that. There's a visceral element to it that isn't available when it comes to buying it as an ebook or audiobook or anything like that. But I don't care really how they read it. I know that our brains do respond differently to reading on screens than they do to print. It's been established by a number of studies. So whether that's better or worse, I don't know. I read a lot on screen still. I read on my phone a lot. I have a Kobo, but I still love print books. And I really love to have that print cover. Indigent Earth has a gorgeous cover. I hope you can show somewhere. It's a beautiful cover that really attracts people's attention.
And in terms of the process of writing, I mean, I appreciate this is a huge topic potentially, and we're approaching the end of our particular chat today. Some writers like to have a musical soundtrack. They actually have a playlist that they put together and they feel they have to have those particular tracks, otherwise it doesn't inspire them. Some people prefer soundtracks to movies. Some people prefer no soundtrack at all, absolute silence. Are there any particular musical elements that you'd like to use to prime yourself up for your creative moments?
Well, you know, I used to be a radio broadcaster. I used to be a radio morning show for my career. That's what I did. So I was listening to music all the time. I absolutely love music, but I cannot listen to music with lyrics, at least when I'm writing. Can't do it. I mean, because you're creating a rhythm as you're crafting each sentence in each paragraph, you can't have something else like that throwing it off. I can sometimes, and especially when I'm outlining or researching or working through the different things, listen to music, instrumental music. And I will, if I do that, tend to gravitate towards soundtrack music. I love the Star Trek movie soundtrack music. It's great. I listen to that. I love some of the other music. One of the ones I love is from the movie called The Rock, where they go to Alcatraz and Sean Connery and Nicolas Cage and stuff. It has a really stirring music soundtrack. And I've always loved John Williams. John Williams is my absolute favorite composer. So anything by John Williams is worth listening to. Beautiful. It's like the classical music of today, his soundtrack music and other soundtrack music. So that would be the answer to your question, I think.
Well, we might actually sort of fit some John Williams material then. Any particular John Williams material that you like? Because obviously he is Steven Spielberg's go-to person of choice when it comes to the whole Spielberg oeuvre. Anyone in particular?
Well, people would, you know, naturally mention all the Star Wars movies, and Superman was great too. But I think some of my very favorite music is in Jurassic Park. The Jurassic Park themes I just adore. And there's just Williams was able to create these melodies that are absolutely wonderful melodies in themselves and yet don't take away from the story. You know, the music is supposed to be background and it's supposed to create emotions and help set the setting and all these different things without being distracting, without taking the focus away from the movie. And he manages to do that. He comes up with these fantastic themes that you just hum along to, sing along to, play along to, and yet they don't detract from the movie. They just add to it. They make it that much better. It was a marvel.
In a few moments, we will have John Williams' theme to Jurassic Park leading into the next small feature, which is with another author who's talking about 100 favorite bike rides that he's been on over his time on the planet Earth, which is extraordinary in its own way. Yes. Scott, it's been terrific connecting with you, good self, today. Genuinely, we haven't even had a chance. I mean, we just mentioned it there, over a quarter of a century as a Radio Morning host in Sudbury, Overton, in Sudbury, I should say. Mm-hmm. So lots of key things from that point of view. But I do have to ask you two final questions. Well, actually three. First of all, what's the best way to actually follow your good self? Do you actually make use of the various social medias? Is there a website? How can people actually stay in touch with you?
Well, the very best way to start is with my website, and it's simply www.scottoverton.ca. Scott with two T's, Overton, O-V-E-R-T-O-N. Easy, easy, easy. Because there you'll find quite a lot, actually. You'll find information about all the books, even on the landing page, and links to various samples of the books. They each have their own page where you can read a sample. There may be book trailers linking to interviews such as this, and also where to buy the books. I really believe in universal book links, which are wonderful because people can click on them, go to that book wherever they choose to buy, whether it's Amazon, Kobo, you know, print from Barnes & Noble, you name it, any one of the UK outlets. So the website's the place to start. I do have a presence on Facebook. I do have a presence on Twitter. Not so much anymore now that it's X.
It's X, exactly. Two final questions, as mentioned then, Scott. First of all, have you had a reasonably interesting Zoomer with us on the Author of the Week feature today?
Oh, I've really enjoyed it. It's been a great chat. You know your stuff, Alex, when it comes to science fiction, and I really appreciate that fact. I grew up on it. My father loved it and really got me into it as a teenager. We would have chats about it around the kitchen table after dinner, drinking tea. And, you know, it's been a big part of my life. So to talk to somebody who knows it well is a great pleasure.
Well, the next critical question is, can we prevail upon you to join us again? Will you come back at some time in the near future and talk more about the adventures of Scott Overton?
100%. No problem at all. Just invite me back and we'll work something out. It'd be a great pleasure.
But we're just talking about triathletes and the performances of the PTO European Open at Ibiza. I wonder, though, whether Ibiza would actually be one of the 100 bike rides of a lifetime, because we're delighted to actually welcome to the programme now the world's ultimate cycling experience author, an award-winning photographer, and indeed a cycling writer, presumably not at the same time. It's the fabulous Rolf Smith. How are you, Rolf?
Not too bad. Well, I have some Spanish rides in the book for sure. Like I said, I have rides. I've tried to include rides that would be for everybody, whether you're super hardcore triathlete types or families out for a ride. I've mixed mountain bike, road bike, gravel bike, expeditions, day trips, a wide variety. The only criteria was that they had to be something special, something really memorable. Mm. And so there are rides from around the world, six continents, and varying lengths.
And again, 100 bike rides of a lifetime. It's quite an inclusive tale that, from that point of view, because oftentimes I think it's not just the ride, but presumably it's also the bicycle or the device that you're actually traveling. I mean, a ride on a penny farthing, for instance, could be memorable, but maybe for all the wrong reasons.
Well, I think if I was to ride a penny farthing, it would be memorable and for all the wrong reasons. I mean, particularly for going downhill on them, they don't have any brakes. Yes. I mean, I tried to make the rides. Yes, some of the rides require particular bikes. I mean, mountain bikes. Some of them are through jungle tracks, and other ones are very much road bike specific, where you want a really lightweight road bike for climbing up some of the fabulous historic mountain passes from the Tour de France in the Alps. The Col du Tourmalet and the Col d'Aubisque. There's quite a variety.
I mean, it's interesting. Obviously, you cover Missouri's Katy Train. You've got Bolivia's Sala de Uyuni. Pronunciation there. New Zealand, of course, you head off to from that point of view. What was the decision that you made in terms of, right, that's the cycle path for me?
Oh, gosh. It was so hard. At first you think 100 rides, that's plenty. And as you go along, you realize you're having to make some really hard decisions and leaving some things out. And then what's really funny is that, after thinking and adding and subtracting and taking things out, coming up with 100 rides, I wanted them spaced around the world. I wanted a variety for everybody. That was really tricky. And then as soon as you finish it and it's gone to the printers, there's nothing more you can do. That's when you start meeting all these people and tell you, oh, didn't you know about such and such? I shot a cycling event in the Dolomites in Italy in September. And I was talking to a pro bike mechanic who was a really keen mountain biker with a lot of experience. And he was telling me about this fabulous ride that you takes you down 500 meters below ground in a lead mine in Slovenia. He said it was the most fantastic ride he'd ever done in his life. And this is a guy who's ridden all over the world. I'd never heard of it. And then he was telling me about riding the old partisan trails up in the northern Italy, during operated by the resistance during World War II. And there's a small mountain bike community that knows where these trails are. And so, there's so many more rides. I feel like I ought to do an annex book, the 50 or 100 rides that didn't make it in the first edition that should have been there. So, culling it down to 100 was very, very tough.
Yeah, I was going to say clearly that there needs to be a second 100 bike rides of the lifetime.
Yeah, we could do 100 just in Britain. Mm. I mean, there's 100 brilliant rides just in Britain.
Share with us the process, Rolf. I mean, was it a case of you did the ride, you took photographs, then you actually wrote about it? Did you actually sort of allow the thing to percolate?
There was a lot of research that went into this. I have done quite a few of the rides, but not all of them. Some of them were recommended by friends or friends of friends. I've done a lot of cycling all over the world and written about it for many years. So I have a good contacts in this area. So, I had this rather large list, probably about 300 rides, and then I had to sort of pare them down, looking for a balance and making really hard decisions. Some of them I cut with great reluctance. Some of the rides just more or less had to be there because they are such classics. You couldn't leave them out. There's a few rides in America that are like that. The Chesapeake and Ohio Rails to Trails. It's very famous. It's a and the Underground Railway route, which follows the route taken by the runaway the enslaved people that were seeking freedom. In it's a fabulous journey. Salar de Uyuni, as you mentioned, in Bolivia. I mean, it's the world's biggest salt flats, and it's surreal landscape. And there's images of it all over the world. You can't not have that one in there. So some of them were just that forced themselves on me. Others were just great discoveries I made as I went along. And some of them are brand new. There's a couple in New Zealand that literally opened while I was researching the book. And I knew people that did them, and they were just stunning. And some of the engineering, you have a bicycle path that's built onto the edge of a cliff. I mean the side of a cliff. There's wonderful engineering, and rather scary if you're not into heights or don't deal with them well. But fabulous stuff that's being built. And there's a few more that were in the works that weren't finished yet by the time I went to print. So again, there's a great, I'd love to do another book.
I'm sure it's the world is calling for it, as indeed is the universe. Did you at any point get competitive, Rolf? Were these kind of rides you wanted to complete in a certain amount of time? I mean, was it a case of, yes, this is my Italian Giro? Or was it just a case of, I want a nice, pleasant cycle?
I have never raced a bicycle in my life. I have gone quickly, but I've never been in a hurry. For me, a bicycle has always been, even from when I was a kid, about exploring, purely exploring. I've got friends that race, and some of them race competitively and done quite well, but I have never been, I would be a terrible Tour de France rider. I love watching the Tour de France, but I would be wanting to stop and shoot pictures off the views.
That's not going to get the yellow jersey, I'm afraid. You're not going to actually.
No, not in fact. I was talking with a guy who won the Tour de France a few years ago, Carlos Sastre, and I was telling him that he just had a bit of a laugh. He said, "Yeah, you don't really get to stop and look at the views. What you do when you're training, but in the race, no." Yeah. I've never been in a hurry. Never wanted to compete. To me, it's always, I'm the slowest guy out there because I stop and take pictures.
Very important, and let's not get started on the Italian Giro, because that's even more stressful, I think, for competitors. But that's entirely. Okay, 100 bike rides of a lifetime is available now, presumably from all good bookstores and online stores,
yes, etc. It's out today, 7th of November.
How can people follow your next set of adventures, Rolf? What else do you actually have in mind?
Well, actually, later this month, I'm moving on to a narrowboat, and I'm going to be exploring the canal network. We've got a fabulous canal network here in Britain, about 2,000 miles worth of it. I'm going to move on to a narrowboat and try to get to all of it, as best I can. Some of them will be a little bit difficult to reach, but because they're not connected. But yes, that's my next adventure. Also very slow. In fact, slower than a bicycle, in fact.
It's travel and mindfulness, Rolf. Obviously, the two things flew together.
Slow travel, absolutely, and local. There's so much in Britain to see. I've been fortunate enough to travel so much of the world, and I realize now that you don't need to get on a plane to go distant places to have that sense of travel and the romance of it and the excitement of seeing something new. You can do it at home.
And can people follow you via the various social media formats, Rolf? Do you have
I'm on Instagram. You see a lot of my cycling photography. In fact, my whole account is pretty much cycling photography. It's just my name, Rolf Smith, at Instagram. And it's all there.
Excellent. Well, Rolf Smith, has been a privilege to connect with you, good self, today. Author, of course, of 100 Bike Rides of a Lifetime, the world's ultimate cycling experience. Huge thanks. And keep on traveling, Rolf.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
There used to be a line which said, no pain, no gain. Well, not that we're actually advocating pain, but maybe just taking a little moment of the day to actually do some exercise, maybe star jumps, perhaps even some burpees if you feel actually ready for that particular level could be useful. Why am I saying this? Well, it's partly tying in with a new survey, which is going to be discussed now by the awesomely talented medic, Dr. Zoe Williams. How are you, Zoe?
I'm good, thank you. How are you, Alex?
Excellent. And obviously, I've just been doing some stretches, so I'm kind of all set and ready for this interview.
Me too, actually.
Yeah. Now, I mean, allowing for that, this is just one of your tips in terms of people who kind of are thinking, you know, oh, well, I'll make that as my New Year's resolution. You can actually forget the New Year's resolution. Actually start now by actually, if you're over 50, if you're over 40, et cetera, looking to maintain your body by doing some basic exercises. Isn't that the whole essence of what we're about to say?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. I think we often tend to wait for January, don't we? We think we'll wait till the new year, we'll make it a New Year's resolution. And then we come up with a New Year's resolution that's far too ambitious that we only manage to stick to for a few days or at best a few weeks. But really, you know, when it comes to looking after our bodies, it's about making lifestyle changes that are sustainable and we can do them every day for the rest of our lives. So there's no point waiting for the 1st of Jan. You just start today. And physical activity, even stretching, you know, thinking about our posture and the way that we sit, all of these things are really important throughout our lives. But I think especially as we get a little bit older.
And why is it particularly important to actually stay active if we're kind of in the kind of cliched over 40 office-based professional who basically obviously has the effort of maybe taking the commute to work and then, of course, the sit-down during the course of the day or maybe a bit of standing up, etc. Why is it so vital that we actually take some time out to do some exercises?
Well, I mean, we're designed as human beings to move, to be in different positions throughout the day, to not be sat down for hours at a time. And, you know, nowadays, with the way that our lives are, obviously, for many of us, either because of our jobs, and which involve sitting at a computer, or because of maybe painful conditions or reduced mobility, people do now tend to sit for 8, 9, even more than that. And there's some new research that's come out from Inora, which has been saying that people over the age of 40, 2/3 of them tend to experience more discomfort as we get older. And that can actually make people feel like they're less, they want to move less. But actually what that is telling us is our body needs to move more.
Functional compound exercises sounds very complicated. Can you explain what they actually are?
So I think when it comes to exercise, we can get a little bit bogged down with particular types of exercise and what's good for us. And my message is always that doing something is better than nothing. So, you know, if you prefer to do something like Tai Chi, yoga, gardening, possibly not so much this time of year, you know, playing with children or grandchildren, hoovering and putting the music on and, you know, really doing it with some vigor, all of these things count. And then, you know, muscle strengthening exercises are really important as well. So trying to increase the strength of our bodies. So that can be simple things like doing some squats whilst you're waiting for the kettle to boil. Even balance and coordination is incredibly important as well. So I often talk to my patients about trying to balance on one leg whilst brushing your teeth in the morning, then balance on the other leg when you're brushing your teeth at night. But I think the message above all else is doing something is better than nothing. And if you enjoy it, you're much more likely to stick with it. And if you do it with a friend, then you're much more likely to stick with it even more. But what's really important as well is exercise and moving our bodies is thinking about that time we spend sitting, thinking about time in the home. And Inora are an organization who makes specialist cushions, and thinking about using medical devices in the home, particularly if we are sitting for long periods of time, if we have mobility issues, this is another thing that people can think about to improve their health and prevent ill health in the future.
So presumably simple and often is better than actually saying, OK, I'm going to actually do that half marathon tomorrow and basically not do nothing else now for the next several months.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. I think doing one half marathon once in your life over the course of your life isn't really going to make a difference. But trying to incorporate more standing during the day, you know, taking some meetings while standing or just doing some simple stretches, or like I said, you know, doing a few squats whilst the kettle boils or when the adverts come on, doing that consistently every day will make a big difference to your health over the course of your life.
those three tips, of course, stretch regularly, check posture regularly, and use support aids in the home. Fascinated, actually, Zoe, by that brushing your teeth whilst on one leg. yeah, interesting. Start off on the morning and then obviously continue at night. It's kind of like a double whammy of health routines. Where can people actually go to, Zoe, to find out further information about what we've been chatting about today?
So you can go to enoracare.com to find out about what we've been chatting about today, and particularly to find out about the air-powered cushions that Enora make that can help prevent poor health in the future.
And just out of interest, when did you come up with that whole notion of one-leg toothbrushing scenarios?
Well, I think with my patients, I'm always trying to think of creative ways to inspire them to get moving. And sometimes actually it's my patients that come up with the best ideas. I think that one did come from a patient because we were talking about balance. And she said, oh, how about whilst I brush my teeth? That's something I do every day. And then I remember to do it. So I think that's a fantastic idea.
Fascinating. Again, amazing. Could be a whole new sport we could be developing. Dr. Zoe Williams, as ever, a delight. Keep on keeping on, and speak to you very soon.
Speak to you soon. Take care.